Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we feature a discussion on paranormal technology, that's audio, visual, electronic devices, and the phenomena produced by them. This includes EVP, that's electronic voice phenomenon, UHF, VHF, and ELF amplifiers, ghost photography, electro-hypnotic devices, that's the Proteus and the Procyon AVS, and Spirit Radio's Then and Now. Our expert call-in guests tonight will be David Roundtree, author of the definitive text on this subject, Paranormal Technology, and Dr. X, Mark Nelson, author of The Multiverse Receiver in the latest issue of our Seventh Ray, Book 3, The Green Ray, which is on Amazon right now. Your host, Poke Runyon, that's me, will act as moderator, and I will try to ask the kind of questions that a non-technical but interested listener would like to have answered about this fascinating subject. So, as we said, tune in and listen very, very carefully, and you might hear voices. Ooh, yeah. Okay, so tonight, this is going to be a very interesting show, and we want to have guest call-ins somewhat later. Let the our two experts get on and start going on this thing, and then later on, you might want to call in. Our guest call-in number is 347-857-1830. Now, one of the things that I want to state from the start here is that, yes, this is a field that we have some actual, you know, interest in and a little bit of experience in. Of course, Dr. X is in the process of designing what we call the Multiverse Receiver, which is an article we have in the latest Seventh Ray, rather detailed and lengthy article, and Dr. X has already built a couple of units. One of them is a replication of the old Hidden World receiver, the VHF amplifier that Ray Palmer published in the Palmer Shaver Hidden World magazine back in 1963. And we built a replica of that, and we've experimented with it. We've also experimented with the ELF, the extreme low-frequency amplifiers. But we, you know, we're in the process of developing this Multiverse Receiver unit, which we'll talk about tonight. Now, our guest expert, who's David Roundtree, that's not Roundtree, that's Round, R-O-U-N-T-R-E-E. David Roundtree is probably one of the top experts in the whole world on this subject, and he has been involved in this for many years. In fact, he's come up from even in the days before computers, he was working with this the days before digital, you know. I mean, so he's been through the whole spectrum of it, audio, video, and everything else. David is professionally, he is an audio engineer, so he certainly is a, technically working. By the way, I've been reading David's book, Paranormal Technology, and I strongly recommend this book. This is it says Paranormal Technology, and the subtitle is Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting. And it's just under that, it says, Roundtree brings his considerable research acumen and scientific knowledge to the paranormal, applying the principle of parsimony and leaving the reader with plenty of grist for the mill. And this is a quote from Dr. S. Rourke. This is a very, very good book and a very good survey of not only of the field, but of David's long history of working in the field. And David is a kind of a romantic kind of guy. He likes to do reenactments. He likes to get out there and have a lot of fun. And so he's one of the romantics like the rest of us, but he's also a very, very astute scientist. And of course, in this sense, right along the line with our Dr. X, Mark Nelson. Both of them take a very hard scientific approach to what they create. Now, what they're researching, what they're doing, and what they're building, and what they're creating, whatever. They take a real scientific approach to it. Now, with me, however, I'm any more romantic than they are, but I take a magical, I'm not a technician and not a scientist, so I take a magical view of this thing. And as I said earlier to both David and Mark, my real interest is I want a machine that I can listen to the other dimensions. I can listen to parallel worlds. I want a machine that will get me, that will take me across the boundary and open the gate to other worlds, other dimensions. And I don't mind talking with the dead, maybe a little bit, but I'm more interested in the parallel worlds and the other dimensions, the spirits and what have you. So consequently, my interest and the interest of a lot of us is in a device that will get you into a receptive state, and that will connect you with a frequency or some sort of a wavelength or some sort of a harmonic that will put you in touch with something beyond. We'll also talk about this. What sort of electro-hypnotic, electro-visionary machines can we create and can we employ? And then, of course, we'll also be talking about, how can we prove these phenomena, and how can we actually prove that there's something going on? What's replicatable? What's evidence? Well, this electronic voice phenomenon, the kind of the white noise sort of thing, is that really proof of something from the other side, or are we using that to key our imagination? Now, ghost photography, I understand from reading David's book and all that the ghost photography is a real, you got to shoot a lot of film, digital or otherwise, you got to shoot an awful lot of it and in order to prove anything, these so-called orbs or dust particles that look like they might be floating paranormal phenomenon or something like that, whether proving this is very, very difficult. We're going to be discussing the various spectrums, electromagnetic, the whole electromagnetic idea, and the interference from conventional electrical sources, and all of this will be discussed. But the history of this whole thing, actually. The way I understand it, and the way Mark and David have been describing it, these spirit radios have been around and have been in use almost as long as radio itself. This has been going. Edison supposedly was getting talking to the spirits. I think Tesla was supposed to be talking to the spirits on the radio, and this has been going on for a long time. And our particular end of it was the Hidden World Receiver, which we built a replica of that and took it up to Shasta and down into Pluto and whatever. And that was a VHF amplifier. It used to use tubes. And, of course, we couldn't. When we rebuilt it, we rebuilt it solid state, but because we couldn't find any virgin commies, you know, virgin commie is a tube, because the Russians still used them. The Russians still had them, so that's what they ended up being called. But we couldn't find any virgin commies, and so we did it solid state on a MEMS design, and yet it was the same circuitry and the same setup. And this was originally developed by a rather eccentric inventor by the name of Edward John. And Edward John developed this unit back in, about 1947 up in Central California, around San Francisco. He developed this, and at this time, it was a VHF amplifier, and he was listening. They called it the StarMic. It was StarMic, okay? This meant they were listening to cosmic rays, and they were listening to cosmic emanations. They were listening to outer space. Now, you remember, in those days, we didn't have any satellites up there, and there weren't any microwaves, and frequency modulation was just coming. You know, that was on the horizon. And television, we didn't have hardly any television sets going in. So consequently, most what was coming down from space at that time really was cosmic. So this so-called Hidden World Receiver, or the StarMic, was kind of an exotic device at that time. Well, anyway, then his protege, John Hatfield Hart, took it over and produced several units called the Hidden World Receiver. In Palmer's magazine, The Hidden World, which he did with Richard Schaefer, John Hatfield Hart published an article, which we have reprinted, by the way, called Building a Hidden World Receiver. That was in 1963. And so that article is in our seventh way, reprinted in Mark's, Dr. X's Multiverse Receiver articles as an appendix. And you can see that original schematic in there for the tube set. And then it became known as the Hidden World Receiver. And at this point, people who had this unit were supposedly tuning into the Darrows in the underground complex that Shaver believed existed, under the United States and all over the world. There were these caverns in which the Darrows had this ancient Atlantean machinery that they were using to contact the surface world and to control our minds and whatever. And they thought they were tuning into the Darrows, and some people were really afraid of these little units, and they got a kind of a spooky reputation. But right now, today, I think that the Hidden World Receiver is a bit obsolete, because there is so much stuff coming down from space that's mundane, like satellite transmissions and television, all kinds of stuff, and microwave and everything else is just pouring in. But that doesn't mean that outer space radio isn't a fascinating subject. In fact, Mark has a website where he connected up to some various other outlets, and I just listened, and Lauren and I just listened tonight to the music, radio music produced by Saturn's rings. And this is so fantastic that it just makes the hairs rise on the back of your neck to listen to Saturn's rings and what and what they sound like over the radio. And so the old StarMech idea is certainly now it's certainly back in favor, even though that simple VHF amplifier I don't think it'll pick up Saturn's rings, but I think maybe our Multiverse receiver, if we get it tuned up right, may very well be able to pick up some. Hopefully, it'll be able to pick up some music of the spheres. Now we ought to have David ought to be calling in pretty shortly. You ought to give us a call, David, and let's get this thing going. I'm just going to try. I'm going to get, now that I've introduced all of this and got you guys started, I'm going to let you kind of take over and explain to us how all this got started and what's going on with it. So you guys can call in. Because I'm just about to exhaust my knowledge of this subject. I want to get the experts on here to talk about it. So David, give us a call, will you? Let me go back for a moment here while David's calling in, and I will read a little bit of the foreword to his book here. Oh, David, are you there? David, are you in?
Actually, this is Dr. X.
Oh, hey, Dr. X. Okay, you're on. Well, David hadn't called in yet. I don't know whether he's having a problem getting on, but we'll get going. We'll get going on your end of it, and we'll get started. If you listen in on my introduction here, let me explain that you're a former NASA engineer. You're an electronic and an electrical engineer, and you're of course the famous Dr. X in Beyond Lemuria, the infamous inventor of the intergravitron. Anyway, we got David on the line over there.
Yep.
Yep. Wait a minute. I'm trying to find out whether David Roundtree is checking in with us here. But anyway, so Mark, while we're waiting for David to call in, why don't you?
I called it.
What?
I called it. I'm here.
Oh, you're David. You're there.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I just
I was in the queue
Mark.
Before. I was in the queue before. I just hung up and called back because I guess you didn't know I was.
Oh, I'm sorry. My lovely engineer here is telling me that it's a technical problem and it's all solved and whatever. So anyway, glad to have you. And now, of course, Dr. X is already on. So what I'd like to do, David, is I want you and Dr. X both to tell us to start with, because you both, you've been in this for a long time. You've been in this for 35. How long have you been? Have you been working in the paranormal for about 35 years?
It's been about 35 years.
Yeah, right. And so what I would like you to do, you start off and then you and Mark, and tell us about the history of this business. Give us a rundown on how this got started and the history of it and your experiences, if you will.
Sure. I probably started out when I was a kid reading everything I could get my hands on. When I was like 8 years old, and it was due to, I'd had some experiences as a child that I couldn't explain and was curious and was trying to learn all I could about it. But I really seriously started doing research in 1976. And my primary focus at the time was on wrought-eye voices, which we know today as the term EVP or electronic voice phenomena. When I started, of course, it wasn't called that. But most of my research in the early days was using big, very heavy, cumbersome TIAC reel-to-reel recorders, old Shure microphones, Sony mixers, things that weighed tremendous amounts of weight that took, you know, like a small trailer to haul around where you went, and certainly nothing like the technology that we have today. But I began studying electronic voice phenomena in those days, and I started developing a theory as to where they were coming from and what they really were, but it took about 25 years before the technology caught up to where my head was at, so I could literally go and test the theories that I had developed back then. But over the years...
What was your theory?
I had a good idea that EVP was being caused by electromagnetic fields, emerging electromagnetic fields that were in the audio spectrum, and how they were being recorded was that they were affecting the voice coil in the microphone, and it was being picked up by the voice coil and not the diaphragm, and that's how they were being recorded. And it turns out about 6 years ago, we were able to run a series of experiments that proved that was the case. But it took us, my God, I started doing this in 1976. 2006 is when we really got the final proof as to you know, what EVP was really being caused by. So that's a long time, you know, 30 years to figure out you were right, but you couldn't prove it, you know, that sort of
thing. Let me ask you, though, let me ask you this now. You proved it, but... My question, and I think the question that our non-technical listeners would probably be interested in knowing, now, is this creating an actual voice that is recordable in other words, you can play to a bunch of disinterested people and they're going to hear the same thing, or is this something that is causing some subjective impression?
Well, no, because I don't grade EVPs. Well, there's a lot of nonsensical talk out there about Class A, Class B, Class C, this sort of crap, and really, honestly, you either understand it or you don't. I mean, how we judge what an EVP is I will take it, I will email it to 5 people on my list, my email list. I have maybe 3,000 people on my email list. I'll pick 5 people randomly and send it to them and ask them what they hear. And if I get 5 responses back that are very similar, the same, or, you know, very close, then I consider it an EVP. And that way, you know, you're eliminating subjective listening, you're eliminating confirmation bias, you know, you're just giving somebody a file and telling them to tell you what they hear. Now, of course,
that sounds good. That sounds to me, that sounds like the way to do it. But it also sounds to me, now correct me if I'm wrong, but it also sounds to me like what we are dealing with here is a subjective interpretation. But if the subjective interpretation is similar, then we realize that we're getting something that the mind is interpreting, but it's interpreting it the same way. Now, am I right on this, am I really on the same track? Yeah.
Sure. The difference is today we have the technology to actually analyze the waveform and do everything from intelligibility testing to, you know, analyze the entire frequency spectrum of what we're looking at. So not only can we take subjective listening and use that, but we can also analyze the file in greater detail than has ever been possible in the past using software, particularly software like SmartLive or APTA software, stuff like that, or ARTA software, where you literally do a spectrum analysis of the waveform. So we can find out a whole lot more about the raw data now than we could 10 years ago.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating, because what this indicates is something that this is a bridge over between what I, you know, kind of my department, the magic department, and in the direct scientific department, because what I've been, you know, concerned about as far as this sort of thing is concerned is that the human mind I believe, and we believe in the magical end of things, is like a receptor and is, we feel, connected to the whole universe. Now, I read the foreword to your book, and in the foreword to your book, or preface to your book, you're entertaining some similar theories there, what we're talking about. So this means that these wavelength, this wavelength, even though it's being, and I'm going to ask you about the audio interpretation in a minute, but this means that we're getting some sort of what you might call a telepathic wavelength. A telepathic, but it isn't actually, it's like a machine language coming through a computer. Am I on the right track here of what you're saying?
Yeah, kind of. It's even better than that. I mean, literally, there is a telepathic carrier wave that we have observed when studying mediums that emerges also from the environment. When I say emerges, it's literally emerging into our universe at a point adjacent to where we are, where we're measuring. And this has spawned a whole series of theories as well to explain this emergence. I'm working right now on finalizing my wormhole theory, which has to do with the multiverse, adjacent universes, and their interactions with our own. But consequently, what is happening is this information is literally emerging into the environment. Now, the interesting thing is when we go and do an investigation of paranormal activity, say there's a haunting or something going on or reported, this stuff tends to be erratic. There's no rhyme or reason to it. You can't predict it. It will emerge. It will last for a brief period of time, and then it will go away. It disappears. There's a lot of associated changes in the environment that happen around it. For example, there are gamma radiation bursts and things like that. So, you know, we know that we're having some type of interface occur where this stuff is coming in. The difference is mediums seem to be able to trigger it, seem to be able to cause it to emerge, and then read information off of it like it's a carrier wave. And essentially, it's a low-frequency carrier wave with information riding on it. And we know this because we can look at the wave, see the low-frequency scalar wave, and then see the information riding on it, modulated on that waveform. So it's kind of fascinating, and it's kind of explains a whole lot. Mediums are essentially biological TV sets that are receiving this information.
Yep. And also too, you mentioned in your section on covering the ghost phenomenon, you mentioned the theory that we've run across before, that these phenomena perhaps are produced by a residual impression of some event that occurred and gets replayed. And that might tend to explain the spontaneous and the kind of spontaneous burst of emotion sort of thing that you get. Would you comment on that? Do you think am I reading you correctly when I say that?
Yeah, I've been entertaining a couple of theories. One of the things that's kind of fascinating about the wormhole theory I'm developing is it would explain residual hauntings as literally you're witnessing the actual event take place in history, where you're looking through the wormhole and you're seeing the historical event as it takes place. It's not residual. You're literally seeing back in time through the wormhole, because wormholes will also not just connect two points in space, but they can also connect two points in time. So the idea is that you may be in such a position that you're literally looking into the throat and seeing the event as it takes place. I think this happens a lot on battlefields, where there are areas where large numbers of people died in a very small area. Those areas tend to be way more active than other areas, and I think depending on where your position spatially may be in that field, you may get a glimpse of a battle as it was really taking place. Fascinating thing.
Yeah, George Patton used to go out on these battlefields and stand there, and I'm sure you've seen that in the Patton film and read that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he would visualize and relive the battle. this is absolutely fascinating, and I think that now you also mentioned in Michio Kaku's I don't know if you cited him directly. I think you cited someone else on the Parallel Worlds. I remember I read Michio Kaku's book on Parallel Worlds, so that comes to mind.
Great book.
But
yeah, it's a great book, by the way.
The Parallel World Theory, naturally being an old science fiction fan and a magician and all that, I just really love the Parallel World Theory. And because I have, and I know you run into this too, I have some friends of mine who are were physicists, and what happens is when I mention other dimensions, they look down their nose and they say, "Oh, you people," and they mean us, you know, us non-physicists. They say, "You people think that another dimension is some other kind of world where everybody is almost the same except they wear different costumes, you know." And he said, "No, that's not what it's all about. We're talking about we're talking in terms of fractals, and we're talking in terms of miniaturization, you know." And the parallel world theory seems to be that, hey, we got, you know, if I read it the same way you read it, it means we have slices. We have slices of similar realities that are stacked up like pages in a book.
Yeah, you kind of use this. I use this analogy like a bunch of bed sheets hanging on a clothesline that are all.
Yeah, you did. That was a great analogy too.
And when the cosmic wind blows, the sheets flap, and sometimes they touch. And when they touch,
Right. Matter
transfers from one sheet to the other. And parallel universes are very similar. They undulate. They move around. And the fascinating thing is, the reason people get all bent out of shape about people talking about dimensions is because there's a misunderstanding. A lot of people think a dimension is a reality. A dimension is one part of a reality.
Yeah.
It's one piece of the pie. The only thing that can live in one dimension is a string. So it takes at least three dimensions. And just take it a step further, if we call time a dimension, it takes four dimensions for a reality to occur that we can even relate to. However, when you think about supersymmetry theory, we have already identified 26 dimensions that are required for supersymmetry to work mathematically. Now, there's no law in physics that prevents four of those 26 that we aren't familiar with to combine into a reality as well.
Yeah.
As long as one of them is time. Or time may have multiple dimensions. For example, we think time may have three dimensions itself. So, you know, if you take that into account as well, that could create another alternative reality based on the combination of any four of those other 26 dimensions that are part of supersymmetry theory. So if you think of it that way, then it's more in context with reality and not like the science fiction version of a being from another dimension, because really it's a being from another universe. And the difference is it's an adjacent universe that has some type of interference occurring with our own. And because of that interference, we experience what we experience that we can't explain.
Yes, but wouldn't you say that it's valid to say that these other universes literally coexist with us, and that if you could breach the gap or have this connection point, like you use the examples of the sheets and the wind touching each other, and we use the interdimensional convergence points in Beyond Lemuria, that if you have this sort of thing, that other dimension, that other world, that other universe, you could walk, you could step right into it, or you could put your hand right into it. Right?
Sure. There's no law in physics that would prevent that. No. And,
that's right.
And see, the thing that's so fascinating is I also write about fundamental frequency. I have a fundamental frequency theory. Our universe could have a resonant frequency of whatever, 5 hertz, 7 hertz, 10 hertz, whatever it is. An adjacent universe could have a resonant frequency of 12 hertz or 14 hertz and could coexist with us in the same region as a wave, and we would never know it existed, and it could be overlapping our own reality, and we would never know it. Because just like when you broadcast a television signal, you have a carrier wave. You have lots of sub-frequencies also riding in that carrier wave, and they are oblivious to one another. And universes may be the same way. We may all be riding on this cosmic highway, and there may be universes all around us occupying the same space, but because we're vibrating at different frequencies, we're all invisible to each other.
Right. Did you ever see a film by David Lynch called Lost Highway?
Yeah, I'm kind of a David Lynch fan, so...
Well, then you've seen Lost Highway. Yeah, you've seen Lost Highway, and you know that Lost Highway, a lot of people just can't figure it out. They just said, well, what is this thing? Well, this is two groups of people living in two of these parallel worlds right adjacent to each other, and they interpenetrate. And they don't realize they are, and this is it. Once you know, once you realize what's going on, you understand what's happening. But they don't, and it is that I really enjoy that film. Would you say that Lost Highway is kind of possible? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm a firm believer in quantum mechanics, and in quantum mechanics you deal with probabilities. You know, everything is possible. It's just a series of probabilities as to how often it would occur, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, it has a high level of probability. I mean, there are so many things that have a high level of probability that when you start looking at things statistically and you realize, well, it may only happen once every 1,000 years, but in the grand scheme of 14.3 billion years of existence, That's pretty regular behavior. So it's all when you put it into context as to what it means.
Right. Let's get Mark on here and Dr. X and get you two guys together. And you had a chance to look over Mark's Multiverse Receiver article. Mark, why don't you tell us what you're trying to accomplish in the Multiverse Receiver design, what you're trying to accomplish, to see whether what David can come up with along that line. Mark, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, Dr. X, you're on.
I'm there. All righty. Nice to meet you, David, even if over wire.
Nice to meet you, too.
Alrighty. I didn't get a chance to fully read your book. It looks very good. I only found out about it about 2 weeks ago, so I'm a little behind in my book reading here.
Well, that's okay.
But, the idea behind the radio came about from a number of sources, the principal one, of course, being Polk's impetus in wanting to build something like this. But we have no theory from which to design something to receive something from another world, so I kind of had to guess at it. And I found some interesting sounds that were recorded by spacecraft as they approached other worlds like Saturn and Jupiter, which in their normal sense was just very interesting, but for somebody with maybe some psychic ability, perhaps, maybe it would be a catalyst for connection. I'd like to play one of them for you now, if that's all right. So let me play this up here. Here we go. Now, that was one of the NASA spacecraft approaching the bow shock of Jupiter, and it just sounds pretty interesting the way that it is, at least to me. Did you hear that, by the way?
Yeah, I'm real familiar with all these recordings, actually. This is incredible stuff, because what it is it's EM that's being generated by the planets, which
exactly.
I think is cool.
I like the rings of Saturn, the music of the rings of Saturn. Oh, God, that is fantastic.
Well, one of them, the interesting thing is actually an interreaction between the sun and the planet's electromagnetic field. That's the thing that's interesting, because that is a representation of pretty much the solar system or the planet's position in the solar system and the sun's activity at that moment. The interesting thing, though, is when it's raised up about 12 tones, it starts to sound like somebody's voices. Here, I'll play this for you. That was the same one.
Cool. That was a different frequency or what?
It was just raised up by 12 tones. That's all it was. It's sort of like this, like perhaps somebody was speaking at a level you couldn't really hear, and this just changed the tone level so you could hear it. But, of course, that isn't likely to be people. But it just goes to show how the electromagnetic waves could carry information that you don't know about. They could be voices. It could be just like David said. It could be the psychic communication. Yeah.
Yeah, information.
Let me try this one on you. This is a little different. Now that one is a sonogram of a picture. It's a picture of Poke with his sword. And it shows you that when you're listening to these sounds, they could carry lots of different kinds of information that, unless we can demodulate them, if you would, or analyze them in the appropriate way, we won't actually know what they're saying or what information is therein.
That's
what intrigued me about natural radio, low frequency, and other sounds like that, and that leads into things like the Schumann resonance, which is somewhere around 7 hertz at various times. And some people think that it's affecting our brain waves, where it's about the same frequency, and if it moves due to natural forces, ours might be influenced by it as well. They have a term for this called brainwave entrainment. I have a couple of links on that website that I sent to you. Lauren, I think it is. You have it, right? You could post that if you wanted to on the blog.
I've got it. Yeah, I got it.
Oh, you got it. All right.
Did you get that?
I don't know your email, Dave.
Yeah, Dave, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think David got it because I don't have his email address. But
I didn't get it, but that's okay.
Yeah. It's a very simple site. I just wanted to put up some stuff so people could go to it after the show. It's the website is www.altair, that's A-L-T-A-I-R, 7SEVEN.com/blogtalkradio. And the B is capitalized, all the rest is lowercase, except for T in talk and R in radio. Hopefully you got that one.
Well, now, let me ask one of the questions that our us non-technical types would might want to ask at this point. Now, we're getting all of this seems to be coming through and being interpreted in the audio range. In other words, our mental receptor. And I'm really, really excited about this method that David's come up with here, where he takes, we get this and we send it out blind to maybe 5 people or more, or we would do it more, and get an interpretation. And if they have a similar interpretation, we know we're on something. I mean, you know, that we're not just imagining it. This is fascinating. And thanks much for that, David, because that's really putting us ahead on this. But what I want to ask both you guys, and that is this. How much of this is the actual electromagnetic communication itself, and how much of this is our audio range interpretation of it? Now, kick that one around a little bit, will you?
Well, take that one, David. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the thing is it doesn't become audio until we listen to it as sound. When we're recording these things, when these spacecraft are recording them, they're not using a microphone out in space to record sound because there is no sound in space. Sound requires a medium in order to transmit, in order to propagate.
Mm-hmm.
What it is recording is electromagnetic fluctuations, and those fluctuations are occurring in the audio spectrum of frequencies. So, keeping that in mind, when you are picking these up with these detection coils, they are going straight onto the recording medium, which in the case of satellites is a digital hard drive, that sort of thing. It is still electronic energy. It's still digital information. Once we convert that and turn it into sound, that's when our subjective hearing comes into play. However, in this case...
But we're restricted. But basically what you're saying is that we are restricted in this sense to what we can pick up in the audio range.
Right. We can only hear sound. Sound is mechanical energy.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
we are looking at from the planets and what these recordings are, or electromagnetic energy. Okay, we can't hear those, but the beauty of it is we can convert it into sound as long as the frequencies are within the sound spectrum of the EMF field. So we can hear what that EMF sounds like by converting it into a mechanical energy representation or acoustic energy.
Okay, let's talk about two things, which one I know you're familiar with, and that's Lucille Ball's tooth. Okay, now you have an example, I understand. You have an example of the woman in the bathtub.
Yes.
And the gal gets in the bathtub, she completes the circuit, and then she starts hearing a radio program just because she stepped into the bathtub. The radio's not on, but somehow or other I've had kind of a similar experience myself. Now, she starts hearing this radio program, and then it turns out that she gets a hold of you, and then you tell her, well, yeah, it's the same radio program, and you play it, so obviously she's becoming her own radio receiver, right?
Yeah. Well, what actually happens is she creates a tank circuit, and literally she's making a filter that's rolling the audio right off the carrier wave of an AM radio station.
Now, so, you know the story about Lucille Ball's tooth, don't you?
Right.
Yeah, okay, well, Lucille Ball, now, I don't know whether this, to tell you the truth, I don't know whether this is an urban myth or whether it's true. But I don't think for our purposes it doesn't matter whether it's an urban myth or whether it is true. It illustrates a point. Lucille Ball, the actress, back in 1942, she has got some dental work in her mouth, and she starts getting Morse code through her tooth. Her tooth starts buzzing. Yeah,
absolutely.
She buzzes. And so she calls the FBI, and the FBI comes over, and they listen to her tooth. And they start, copying code down, and they say, it's coming out in five-letter groups. Aha. So they get an RDF truck, and they put Lucille in the RDF truck, and they drive around Hollywood until they find this little Japanese guy up there in a walk-up apartment with a radio sending messages to Tokyo.
Yeah.
That's the story. But
That's not unusual. Many people have their dental work literally because of small cavities that aren't filled or the improper filling of a cavity, and it becomes a resonant tank circuit, and they pick up broadcasts in their head, and it drives people crazy.
Yeah, I think also you get a diode effect with dissimilar metals in your tooth fillings, too, along with the saliva.
Sure.
I've actually generated a small amount of electrical current from some old fillings in the past that were shocking to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of different things in play here, and it's not far-fetched. It's actually very easy to screw up and have something happen like that.
And then, of course, there's Shaver's welding torch. And Richard Shaver, back in during World War II, or right before World War II, he's working in Detroit with an electric welder on an assembly line in the Ford Motor Company. And every time this welder comes around, every time he actuates the welder, he started hearing voices and they were strictly connected to the solenoid in the welding torch. So he starts hearing voices. And at first, the voices, now this is what really interesting, first the voices are in the plant. There are people in the plant, in the offices or nearby or whatever. He's hearing their voices. And then as this continues, he starts hearing voices from according to him, the caverns below where the Darrows were down there doing horrible things. And that's where it starts to get, you know, and of course, as we all know, Shaver really did spend some time in a mental institution, so that tended eventually to discredit all of his stuff. But the welding torch, now, this is kind of like the tooth. It's sort of like Lucille Ball's tooth. Could you actually hear voices through a welding torch, do you think?
Well, you know, I would have to say, just by saying it, I would have to see if it wasn't some form of pareidolia first or some type of apophenia where you're making order out of chaos with your mind. Is it possible? Anything's possible. But there's really not enough.
The people are hearing evidence actually,
to make a conclusion. So I mean,
yeah,
we're speculating.
But people actually, according to what you're saying now, and I didn't realize this. I knew the story about the tooth, and I knew the Morse code in the tooth, and I had no problem with it all. But people could actually hear voice radio through their dental work. And actually, it bothered them because they were getting voice radio programs in their head. Mm-hmm. And you're saying this is actually happened. That actually has happened.
Yes, it has.
Oh boy, and that's confirmed. I mean, that's not their imagination.
Oh, there's lots of cases of it documented. Lots of cases.
Oh boy. Well,
people thought they were going crazy. I mean, people literally thought they were going insane because they were hearing voices in their head.
Yeah, and of course, this opens up a very, very sinister thing here. But let's say if someone could build a transmitter, would it be possible for someone to build a transmitter that would directionally affect people like this, and actually use this to drive them crazy? Do you think this is possible?
Well, I not only think it's possible, I know it's possible. I know it's being done. I know it's been done. Not so much to drive people crazy as to control behavior.
Right.
I mean, there were experiments done, in fact, in Utah at a prison by government researchers to affect the behavior of a prison population by doing just exactly what we're talking about right now.
What was the dental work? What they were using as the catalyst,
it was more insidious than that. Actually, they were literally using specific frequencies, broadcasting specific frequencies to alter brain function in order to, adjust behavior.
Well, I understand now. Way back when we first got the OTA started, and my friend Nelson White, who was also a NASA engineer, he suggested that this was back in 1970, and Nelson suggested that we use extreme low frequency tonalities as a security device to keep people from entering our premises. He said if we surround our facility with extreme low frequency projectors, this will make them people so uneasy and so uncomfortable they won't come anywhere near it.
Oh yeah.
And I didn't believe it, but that's what he said. We didn't do it, but I mean that was extreme low frequency. Is that what they were using on this prison thing?
Very specific low frequencies, yeah.
Very specific low frequencies. This is why I know our I had experience myself. Our our cell phone tower, which is over on a hillside about a mile from my house. For some reason or other, it started putting out a very low frequency, very, very resonant, and it was made me very uncomfortable. And I did that so much so that I called up the sheriff's department and I said, hey, look, these guys have got this tower over here. They've got this thing, and they're broadcasting it all over the canyon, and it really is uncomfortable. And no sooner did I call the sheriff's department, and this has been on for an hour, and they said, well, don't worry about it, and then it went off. That's it. So I know, now the next question is, using extreme low frequency, like our ELF unit, could you transmit you transmit either recognizable transmission or some sort of code transmission? Is that how they were doing this sort of thing?
No, they were actually doing it very very on the sly. I mean, it wasn't detectable at all. And a lot of it
is. It should be subliminal. In other words, it was subliminal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They had no idea what was going on, and you can't tell, because you don't hear it, you don't feel it, but your body and your consciousness is reacting to it, particularly your perception. So, yeah, I mean, Dr. Michael Persinger has done a great deal of research on this. He developed a device called the God Helmet, and in it he was able to stimulate the frontal lobes of subjects with specific low frequencies and trigger experiences for them to... They were like seeing God or feeling paranormal experiences based on this artificial stimulation from these low-frequency EMF fields that he was subjected to. And the same thing occurs. We study this, in fact, during a paranormal event, because these same low frequencies are present during a perceived paranormal event. And part of the challenge that we have in doing the research is determining how much of it is the consciousness reacting to the stimulation, and how much is it due to the result of the actual environmental changes that the event is causing. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach, because the observer effect is a big part of it, because
the extreme low frequency is the when it comes to communicating subliminally, that extreme low frequency is the field of choice in this sort of an operation. Would you think that's the case?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, right. I know that I was experimenting with the ELF unit that Mark came up with. And you put a headset on, but it's a real simple thing. It's got an off and on switch and a gain, and we put Mark, you're still there, aren't you?
Still here. One thing about the guy helmet, though, one thing to consider about it is it's magnetic dominant rather than electromagnetic, so
that's a misnomer. He's using frequencies. Yeah,
if it was
magnetic, it would be static, you know, and he's using very specific frequencies. I mean, he's calling it magnetic, but it's electromagnetic.
But with the ELF unit, I figured out the problem with the ELF unit, Mark, is you didn't have a ground, and so we got a lot of static. But when I put my finger up on the antenna, then I grounded it myself. And then I get this deep resonant field, and it's like almost like you play with the game a little bit. You get a zero beat effect. You get it like a zero beat, you know, down. And then once I got that zero beat, it was a very not an uncomfortable feeling, but a sort of an ominous feeling that I was about to hear something. You know what? I was listening in on something, and I wasn't right there yet, but I could tell that the field was a feeling of presence. Let me put that. It's like we get in magic when we're about to receive a vision in magic. It was this feeling of presence, and so that was my experience just recently with the ELF. Now I haven't heard anything come through with the ELF yet, but this is fascinating. It's also disturbing. I wasn't aware of it.
It's very disturbing.
Now, Yeah. So are you David, do you think that this technology is being used and misused at the present time?
I know it's being used. I mean, I've personally developed non-lethal weaponry using both acoustic energy and low-frequency EMF as part of, you know, developments for homeland security applications and things of that nature. So, I mean, the technology is currently in use. It's being used, I know for sure, in several responsible ways. But, you know, of course, any technology is also usable in irresponsible ways. So,
yep.
You know, there's always that chance that that's going to happen out there. And a lot of times in the name of science, it is done. And it is done to, to discover what kind of effects it has on the human psyche. And sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's not so good. So,
well, yes, and then, this is one of these things that, like, you know, Shaver, of course, one of my favorites. When I was 16 years old, I bit on the Shaver mystery, and I was kind of an introverted, nerdy kid, and I really, really got into it. And boy, when this woman, Mary Reeser, burned up right around the corner from my house, and she burned up from the inside out and left nothing but a leg and a shoe. And a little smoking hole in her couch. I thought, you know, that they were aiming at me and hit her by mistake. You know? So I was that much into it. But all my friends talked me out of it. Of course, you know, Shaver was nuts, and the science fiction writers didn't like him because he was attracting too many lunatics to science fiction. And yet, it seems that some of the things that Shaver was predicting seem to have been coming true, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm not turning around and going back to believing in Shaver, but still, it looks we're in an age right now in which so many of these things that we thought were fantasy before are coming around. Mark, you want to talk about that God helmet from your point of view? You were telling me something about that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's called a Shakti helmet in one particular incarnation of it. Have you heard of that, David?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
What do you think of it?
Well, I mean, I've seen the results. I mean, I've actually interviewed Persinger. I've talked to him in great length about his own work because a lot of what he's doing parallels a lot with some of the stuff I'm doing, and particularly the study of low frequency effect on the consciousness. But yeah, I mean, he's the thing that's kind of fascinating is he uses combinations of frequencies in these sensors. So he's creating a very complex electromagnetic field. And I mean, he calls it a magnetic field, but because he's using frequency, of course, it's really electromagnetic. Because there's an electric field as well as the magnetic field. But he's not a physicist. You know, he's a neurologist, really. So when you get into it, what he's really doing is he's taking very specific parts of the brain and he is pinpointing very specific stimulation to that point in the brain. And he can literally focus that stimulation deeper than the surface area of the brain there so that he can pinpoint specific areas to excite. And by doing that, he can play around with the mix of frequencies and determine exactly how to make somebody behave or to have them feel a specific thing. And it has incredible potential of being able to be a tool for treating people with mental afflictions as well.
Yeah, I've noticed that aspect of it. The reason why I was just mentioned the magnetic aspect of it is on two levels. One is the coils are wound so that there's the coils at right angles to the core. The core is pointing straight into the brain. And what it appears to be doing is generating a small electrical field causing synapses to fire. They have a term for that. It's transcranial direct current stimulation or magnetic stimulation. And that's why I thought of that. The other side of it is with regards to the welder that Pope was referring to, it would seem to me that has a very strong magnetic field as well and may well have caused a similar effect.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of jury's still out on magnetic influences and fluctuations and things like that, you know, and their effects and stuff. But, you know, human beings have a small amount of magnetite in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've heard this.
I've often wondered what effect that has on some of the things we're doing. Now, I've heard of people who have had MRIs that have had bad reactions to the MRI, and it turns out that it was because they had a higher than normal concentration of magnetite in their brain. And and because of that, of course, that magnetite would be resonating like crazy during the MRI scan.
That,
you would think, you know, that has to be some kind of factor in some of these effects. And I've always been curious as to how much of a factor it is.
Well, it's hard to say. I've had a direct experience with that. It was kind of interesting. I once was at a test facility, and I walked into a room, and I found myself immediately disoriented. And I asked the person in charge there why that could possibly be. And it turned out the room was magnetically shielded with new metal. And apparently, at least some people are aware of the magnetic field of the Earth, but since you grew up with it that way, you're not used to it. I mean, that is, you're so used to it that you don't know it's there until all of a sudden it's gone. And that was a real effect I learned about directly.
Now, let me ask you guys about something else here, a favorite of mine. Sometime back in the 1960s, a kind of a beatnik character by the name of Geisen came up with a thing called the Dream Machine, the Geisen Dream Machine. And all this was really was a tube with a paper tube with a bunch of cutout shapes in it. And he put this thing down on a turntable, a stereo turntable, and he hung a light bulb in the middle of it. And then he turned the turntable on, and then he put his nose right up to it, closed his eyes, and as this turntable revolved, and as the light came through these holes, he got a sort of a kaleidoscopic effect behind his eyelids, and this got him into an alpha state and got him into a visionary kind of a psychedelic state. Somehow or other, the fact that his eyes were open, it didn't happen. But I mean, when he closed his eyes, and he starts getting this very elaborate kaleidoscopic effect. So he started building these things for people, and he called them the Geisen Dream Machine. Well, once we went into the digital age, some people got a hold of this and updated it. And one outfit I know that I have a thing called Procyon, which is the son of Proteus. And this, you put on a pair of goggles. You got some LEDs in the goggles. And then you put a headset on, and you've got this program, and this little thing about the size of a pack of cigarettes, and it also these different programs, about 40 of them. And what you have here is a synchronization of the visual LED pattern, which stimulates, just like the Geisen effect, it stimulates all these rod and cone cells in the eyes to produce all this kaleidoscopic sort of stuff, very intricate. And then you get a tonality at the same time, and they claim various relaxing effects and stimulating effects and all of this for it. Now I've used this thing, and for entertainment, also for relaxation and whatever. I'm wondering if this kind of technology can be used for anything more than just entertainment, or if we could actually use this sort of thing for creating meaningful transmissions, meaningful experiences, something really worthwhile in the way of experiential communication. Would you want to talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, Mark.
Go ahead. Well, with regards to the flashing lights, they know that they can kind of semi-hypnotize you, and they know if you're epileptic that if you run it around 4 hertz, you'll probably go into a seizure, so you have both ends of the spectrum there. The other possibility is with some of those sounds that I described and things like the Schumann resonance, perhaps you can make the light synchronize to that in some pattern that also could kind of open you up if you're somewhat psychic, or even if you aren't, maybe it will push you in that direction. That's about the only thing I can think of along those lines.
Well, David, have you had any experience with this kind of these kind of units, and do you have any thought about them?
No, we played around with strobes and stuff before, which is a similar thing. Based on the frequency of the flashing lights, you're going to affect people. And just as mentioned, I mean, people that have afflictions are more sensitive to it than others. But I mean, we have all had experiences with strobe lights and things like that where we've gotten disoriented before, even though it might have been momentarily. But there are some people who you could literally send into another existence with this stuff if they disconnect.
Well, what I'm wondering though, actually, along the line with we were talking about this business of, well, with the extreme low frequency communicating a subliminal message that actually either makes them very depressed or terrified or induces some kind of vision or behavior or whatever. What I'm wondering is if this could be also linked to some sort of visual kind of a thing. And I'm not trying to develop the ultimate brainwashing unit or anything like that. I'm just wondering. I'm just putting this out because what I wanted to do with the Multiverse receiver, and then when we were first getting into designing it, I wanted to have a visual aspect to it. And Mark came up with this idea of, like he said before, he could take a picture. He took a picture of me holding a sword, and he took that picture, and he made a sound. He made a sound replica of it. And, mm-hmm. and he played the sound of the picture, and then he said, "Now this is the sound of the picture." And I thought, "Well, wait a minute. If we do this, why can't we project the sound of the picture, and then also have the picture too, and then have the sound of the picture, so we can get across a multi-level thing, and can't we develop?" Something that projects, well, what they do this, this is done anyway with in an abstract pattern. We have it all the time. You see it on the screen on your computer. I mean, every time you serve some YouTube or some podcast and whatever, they have these swirling matrices that are generated by the sound of what you're doing. Now, what I'm wondering is, can we combine subliminally? Can we combine the visual and the audio images that we're projecting? One or the other of you, or both of you, tell me what you think about that.
Well, I'll take that one for the moment. Yes, you definitely can. I have a visualizer here, for instance. When I played that sound picture of you, it was really quite spectacular. So definitely, you can do that. What's your take, David?
It's all in a matter of how we present it. It's all in a matter of how we break it down and reassemble it. I mean, all you're doing is you're converting. You're converting data from one format to another, and it's very easy to affect perception by doing the same thing. And all of these things are tools. When you use it collectively, it's a much more powerful tool. So if you're taking the sound of the picture as well as the picture and using them both together, both of them are reinforcing one another, so it's making what you're doing more powerful.
I would think so, definitely. That's one of the things that we were – Mark, I don't want to put you on the spot about this, but are we able to do that at this present point with our design? I mean, are we in that ballpark?
Well, the design is kind of interesting from the standpoint that it's a modular design. The core of it is the digitizer and the analyzer and the mixer part, so that you can do things like down conversion. What you do on the front end, though, tells what you're down converting. It could be an electromagnetic wave, it could be a magnetic wave, or it could be sound. So you can down convert sound that you can't normally hear as long as you have a microphone or some other sensor that can pick up that higher frequency. The same is true of any of the frequency components that you might want to pick up over the air. You just down convert it using one of the components built into the receiver. They call it tetradyning, and then filter out the parts that you don't want and listen only to that band that has now been down converted to a level that you can actually hear. So, yes, the answer.
Oh, boy. Yeah. We can't wait. When are we going to be able to plug this thing in and oh boy, I'm excited about this about, you know, we've been working on this thing for a while. We aren't going to be. I wish we could open up one of David's wormholes like we did with our intergravitron. David, I don't know. Have you seen our goofy movie Beyond Lemuria? You haven't seen that yet, have you?
No, I haven't. I'm not going to
recommend it overly, but because it's kind of hokey, but we had a lot of fun. We designed this machine called the intergravitron, and deep gravity being the only force that goes between dimensions, you know. So we call this thing the intergravitron. Mark worked on it. I worked on it. We put it together, and then our director of photography was also a kind of a special effects guy. He did a lot of special effects with it. And we opened up vortexes with it. We took it down in the cave, and we opened up vortexes, and we went through wormholes, and we did all sorts of stuff with the intergravitron. It was a lot of fun. But I think, though, that even though being able to open up the wormhole and actually walk through like we did in the movie, I think, you know, really that tell me what you think. I think we're getting pretty close to where we can actually communicate. How close do you think we are, really, both of you? Give me a prediction. How soon are we going to be able to actually get a communication going with one of these other universes or in these other worlds? What do you think?
From the scientific point of view, or just from the psychic point of view?
Well, just give me a. When are we going to be able to do this? I'm. Or are we doing it now and we don't even realize it?
That's probably about the time they come up with a definition for what a ghost or what life after life actually is. David pointed out that there is no definition, no good definition for a ghost. And if you don't have a good definition for something, you can't really design something to detect it very effectively. It may even be outside of the range of anything that we're familiar with right at the moment. So we're kind of up a creek in that case. We'll be designing something that receives everything except what we're looking for.
Yeah, exactly.
And we don't know what it is, but we're going to design it anyway. Well, you know, actually, what is it that the internal combustion engine is really not anywhere. It isn't supposed to be anywhere near as efficient as it is, but somehow or other we wanted it to be, and so we've made it very efficient. And somebody also said that the bumblebee can't fly, but it does anyway. So I'm hoping that we can come up with something. But I really, one of the things that absolutely fascinates me about what David said was this method of blind testing. I never realized that this would be a way of doing it. You know, after I got, you know, had my second thoughts about Shaver after all my friends jumped on me and I started being kind of cynical and I felt ashamed of myself. Then I became very cynical. And you take, for instance, Blavatsky, you know, we all know now, of course, that Blavatsky had to move her two Sikh Sangh gurus up to Tibet to keep them from being arrested by the British. So she had to put them in Tibet. Nobody knew what Tibet was at that time. You know, it was only, she took her two gurus who were giving her bankrolling her and everything else, moved them up to Tibet and said, oh, they're, you know, the Kuthumi and Moria, they're in Tibet and all that. And this spawned after Blavatsky, I mean, Alice Bailey and Annie Besant and all these people, including poor old Philos. I mean, even Philos got called the Tibetan. Everybody was getting all this stuff from Tibet, but it wasn't Tibetan. It just wasn't. I mean, and so we know that the channeling thing. We have these problems. We the imagination just runs off and does what it wants to do. So I think this business that David came up with of using, we get this stuff and taking these blind testing the impressions. This will put the channeling business on track, right?
Well, that is the essence of the scientific method. So absolutely, I agree 100%.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, David, you're familiar with what I'm talking about with Blavatsky and Besant and Bailey and the rest of them with this phony Tibetan thing.
Yeah, oh yeah. And I mean, that part of the problem that we have as legitimate researchers is the phony crap that's out there. You know, the people that are doing the hoaxing, that are doing the fraud, that are doing all these things, they make our job 20 times worse than it normally is, because now we have to not only overcome the prejudice against the field, we've got to overcome the prejudice against the fakers that are out there trying to make a buck off the public. So it's very difficult when you're doing this kind of work.
I agree with you 100%, but let me correct myself here. I am not trying to say that Blavatsky and Bailey and Besant and even Frederick Spencer Oliver or any of these people were actually doing a hoax. They actually, this is the sad part about it. Blavatsky had to do this to keep these two guys from being arrested. And Sikh Sant's a very valid spiritual tradition. And these guys, these Kuthumi and Murya, these so-called ascended, these really were gurus. I mean, you know, that was all real. And she moved them up to Tibet, and she did this to protect them at their request. And so I'm not faulting Blavatsky that much anymore. I used to fault her, but I'm not faulting her. But then look what happened. Then Besant and Bailey, and I don't think they were faking either. I mean, they were getting this, they were believing this, but then they were going off on that wrong track. And so we not only have hoaxers that you're talking about, and I know there are a lot of them, not only have the hoaxers, but you have the well-meaning people who are just off on the wrong track. Their imagination is generating. You know, it's like in remote viewing where they say their first impression's got to be it, and don't wait for an analytical overlay, because if you get an analytical overlay, you're gonna skew it, and then your imagination's gonna take over. So I think I'm really happy about your method, your blind method for that. I think that'll put the channeling business back on track.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think some of the work I'm doing also in this emerging EMF that's occurring around this sort of activity too is going to be very important, I think, as well. You know, for years everyone's been trying to quantify how a psychic or a medium or channelers, how they're actually working. And I'm starting to get an insight as to maybe how they are. And I think it's very important that we explore this, because I think it's going to answer a lot of questions.
Yeah, Mark, what do you think about this, business of the channeling and whether or not we can actually get this get channeling in the future on a more like remote viewing? We can impose more of a discipline on it. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm sure that you can impose various rules and techniques to it to make it much better or much more reliable. How that would be done, the only thing to do is just do a major research effort on it with a lot of people and see which technique works, make notes of what does work and what doesn't, and then refine it from there. Just like David said, though, it needs to be repeatable, and it needs to be observed by disinterested parties. Otherwise, you'll kind of have a prejudiced point of view to it already, and then you'll tend to come up with what you already came up with. So that's
yeah.
Not too helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I really think that this is excellent, and what are your plans in the future? Got any new books in the works? Are you working on anything that you're going to be coming out with?
Yeah, I'm working on another writing project right now. I'm also working on a potential idea for a television show. I'm also working on potentially an organization that may try to professionalize paranormal research. I'm working on a lot of different projects. It's just some of them are further along than others. Some of them get set back and that sort of thing. But right now I'm working with a friend of mine on a story that is a little off the beaten trail from the kind of stuff I usually write, because it took place back in 1985. But it's kind of it's more of a metaphysical story. Not so much the science aspect, more of the metaphysical aspect of an experience that I had in 1985. So we are working on putting that together, and it's been a very slow and long process just because of the nature of the story. But that's kind of the priority thing that I'm working on right now is working on that book.
If it's not a full length, are you going to be a short story, or is it going to be a medium length, or is it going to be a whole book?
Oh, it's going to be a book, yeah. I mean, it took place over a three-month period, and that three-month period was like 5 years.
Oh, boy.
It was an intense 3 months, and there's a lot to tell. I mean, the outline was like 140 pages. So.
That's a book. If the outline's 140 pages. That means it'll be three times that long. You got a lot.
Yeah.
You got a long one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
that one.
Yeah, we're gonna try to keep it down to about 400 pages maximum. There's a lot that went on, and we have to figure out a way to tell it in an efficient manner, and so that it has impact. You know, so it still keeps its impact. But that's kind of the project right now. And I've got, like I say, there's other irons in the fire, but they're moving at their own pace. I mean, what I do with them has already been done, and so, like, it's in the hands of fate right now as to where it's going, but that sort of thing. But the book is definitely something I'm in control of.
When do you expect to get this thing published? Because you got a working title?
No, we haven't got a title for it yet, but I'm thinking it's probably going to take us the better part of this year to write. I'd like to have it finished, if possible, before Christmas, so it can go to the publisher before Christmas. But, I'm speculating, because it's really a difficult book to write because of the nature of what we experienced and what the story's about. It's a lot of us blocked a lot of it out of our minds. And part of the process is bringing back that information, retrieving that information. So,
you took a lot of notes. You got a lot of notes on it. I find, I don't know whether you agree with this or not, but I find that all of these psychic experiences that we, because we operate on a regular basis, doing evocation, invocation, whatever, you have to write them down, detailed. Detailed report right after you have them, or even have a scribe right down there with you while you're having them. You got to do this immediately because they're like dreams. They fade out. Even though the experience is very intense, you get a lot of information. If you don't get it written down right quick, it goes out of your mind. And you can't remember it. And it's like recalling. You probably have worked on dream recall. I think most of us have at one time or another. Mm-hmm. And you got it when you wake up. You don't even want to move when you wake up and you've had a dream, and you're like, You don't even want to move. You don't want to move your body at all. You want to sit there and, all right, I know I'm awake. Now I'm going to remember exactly what I dreamed. But if you even move, if you stretch, if you roll over, you're liable to lose it.
Oh, yeah,
you know
sure.
What I mean?
I used to keep a journal by my bed, and when I would wake up, I would immediately write down my dreams. And that was like the only way that I could keep track of it, because once I got moving around, it was gone. So,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a journal was very helpful.
Absolutely. We had a show, it's, you know, all our shows are archived. We had a show on lucid dreaming. And on remote viewing and lucid dreaming, we ganged those two up together. I don't know how well they fit together, but we did both of them. And I keep it, you know, I'm into my third dream record now. And if I have a real good one or a lucid one especially, I'll just very, very, you know, I'll just lie there and I'll just make sure I got the whole thing done while I'm, you know, just about out of that hypnagogic state. I get it down in my mind. And then I wake up and turn the light on and write it down. Yeah, that's the way you have to do it. Mark, on the Multiverse Receiver. Now we have the ELF unit. Of course, we're using that now. On the Multiverse Receiver, we're going to have enough ELF capability where we'll be able to actually get an improved capability on the extreme low frequency end, right?
Oh, definitely. You'll be able to hear almost anything in that realm, even lower frequencies than you can normally hear. You can up-invert them as well.
Well, that'll be good, because that's something we definitely want to be able to exploit that. Now, let me ask you this about the article. Would you say that your article in the Seventh Ray, when you cover the history of all of these units, tell us a little bit about how this got started way back when radio was first started, because I was covering that at the beginning of the show. But I'd like people to, you know, I'd like our listeners to know that this is not something that just started overnight with the digital age or whatever. This has been going on for a long time. How did all this get started? Where did it start and where did it get going? Can you tell us that?
Well, in a general sense, yes. It's basically started with the beginning of radio of any sort, because as soon as they started receiving or building receivers of any sort, they started receiving signals they didn't understand what they were. That happened to Nikola Tesla. He thought he was listening to signals from Mars, and he may well have been listening to signals from old Jupiter, as an example, much like you heard earlier. A lot of the signals that we pick up even today are not understood what they are. There's a couple of them on YouTube that you can hear called the Bloop, and they don't know quite what that is. There are other sounds that were man-made, like the Russian woodpecker, which some actually believe was trying to control our mental state in this country. So there's a big range of things from then to now. One of them, of course, is the article that I put up together was about Edison and his efforts to communicate with the dead. Unsuccessfully, unfortunately. It would have been nice if he'd been able to do that. But other people started looking into things like natural radio, thinking that the sounds that they picked up that were naturally created in the atmosphere might represent something else. And then when science came along, they found out, no, they were naturally created either by the magnetic field or electrical activity in the atmosphere or some interference by the sun and activity on the sun. So that's a kind of a rough history of it. Other than that,
yeah,
I'm not quite sure what you're looking for.
David, would you want to add anything to that on the historical background of this? I've already discussed Edward Johns and the StarMech and the Hatfield Hart Sid World Receiver. Now, we've all, I think we're familiar with with the thing called Frank's Box and some of these more recent units. David, what's your opinion of some of these units? I mean, some of the more recent stuff. You think
they're fascinating items. They're not very usable as gathering any kind of scientific data because you can't differentiate from the many things that could be causing it to what is causing it. That's always been my beef with it. I've taken these things apart. I know exactly how they work. And what most of these newer items are doing is they're taking an AM radio tuning chip, and they're taking the ground off or either over-biasing the tuning circuit so that it randomly tunes across the dial. And they can adjust that scan rate so that they can pick up bits and pieces of phonetics. Now, when you do that, of course, 50% of the time, you're going to make total sense with the English language doing that. That's just the nature of the language. So it's very difficult to quantify any of it with any kind of real meaningful evidence because there's so many other things it could be that don't get eliminated by any other means. So
that's almost like the Bible code. I mean, you know,
sure.
the people that take a page out of the Bible and then they, or the Hebrew Bible, and they jam all the words together and all the letters together, and then they look for stuff, and then they predict the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, sure.
And,
well,
and,
I mean, you know, you can do it with any book, actually. I mean, they proved that they could take Moby Dick and predict stuff with it. So,
well,
you know,
some guy really. And of course, I'm not claiming to be that much of a capitalist, but some guy, you know, they say, well, look, they predicted the Kennedy assassination. I said, do you have any idea how many ways you can spell Kennedy in unpointed Hebrew?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this one, yeah. Well, Mark was mentioning this to me that this was one of the things you can do with this is you can roll right through a whole bunch of different radio channels and just pick up a word here and a word there and or a sound here and a sound there
and it
becomes a word. Yeah.
The thing is, here's the thing. You know, if these things really spoke to the dead, like these people claim that they do, don't you think that would be like on TV and like all across America, newspapers, media taking it and running with it? I mean, really?
Well, yeah.
let's use some common sense, right? You know? But the problem is that when you look at these things scientifically, there's hundreds of sources for what they're getting, and none of them are paranormal. So how do you differentiate from what is normal and what is paranormal with these devices when there's no means of differentiation built into the circuitry? So you have to kind of look at it that way. They're fascinating things. They're interesting. You know, you get really compelling audio files from them. You know, you hear things that, you know, make a whole lot of sense to what you're dealing with. But the fact of the matter is it doesn't constitute scientific proof of anything other than theory of RF reception. So, you know, I mean, it's a difficult thing. And, you know, you try to explain it. See, my idea would be if you want to establish two-way communication, you know, you would use something very similar to the way these things are communicating with us, which is what appears to be in the area that I'm researching is EMF in the audio spectrum. So if we were to speak into a microphone and have that transmit out of a coil as EMF energy and then be able to receive it back from the same format, it would seem that would be a much better idea of trying to have some kind of two-way communication with whatever it is that is leaving these EVPs. And that's the kind of stuff we're playing around with right now.
Where are you at on that, Mark?
Well, kind of in the same realm, what I was looking at is the electromagnetic spectrum and converting it into something that you can hear or see, which is very much like David is talking about. You might be able to do the reverse of that in taking some signals, be it sound or whatever, and converting it into a magnetic flux and see what that does to the environment or to somebody nearby. That's kind of what the God Helmet is doing, except they're doing it in little tiny tiny coils where I was thinking about doing in a very large coil.
Now, this ground helmet, let me ask you, back to this again, because we established at a certain point in our conversation here, we established that most of this technology is limited to the range that we can pick up through our audio. In other words, we're not going to get something that a dog can hear, and this is going to be below the range that the dogs can hear. So, and above the range that the frogs can hear, I guess, or whatever. That's if we in the audio end of it. But with the God helmet, it sounds to me like maybe we're putting electrodes right on the head. Are we?
That's how I understand it.
See, the thing is we have this incredible armored device called a skull. And what that skull does is it protects our brain from the stray EMF fields in the environment unless they're at a specific strength. What the God helmet does is focus that EMF on a very specific region very close to the skull, so that it penetrates through the bone of the skull and goes into the actual area of the brain. And in that aspect, it's sort of artificial, because the chances of you getting that level of EMF stimulation in a natural environment are fairly slim, even if you were right up on the source.
Yeah, but we're going beyond the audio range when we do this. In other words, we're up in the range that the puppies can hear and the porpoises can hear and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, actually, when we're stimulating the brain, we're usually down below what we can hear. We're down in the infrasonic range.
But below what we can hear then. So what I'm trying to get at is that we're bypassing the audio filter. Right.
Yes. Well, we're doing that when we're dealing with EMF anyway. As I say, our audio filter has to do with our perception of mechanical energy, and we're dealing with electromagnetic energy. Now, they are transposable based on their frequency spectrum, which is kind of the neat thing about measuring EMF. You can measure EMF using a microphone and an oscilloscope, because the coil of the microphone is responding to the EMF frequencies. You can literally cut the diaphragm out of a microphone, so it's just the voice coil, and you can still record EVPs with it. And that's another clue that it's EMF.
You should make it clear that that's a dynamic microphone only, though. It doesn't work with the other types.
That's right. It doesn't work with a condenser mic, and it doesn't work with an Electret mic. So, you know, these people that are getting these voice files on these small little recorders that have Electret microphones on them, what they're getting is bleed over into the actual electrical circuitry. They're not, the microphone isn't even a factor in what they're recording. Because what they're recording, it's being picked up by the electronics. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the incredible thing about it is that the EMF is going to bleed through a cheap device, particularly these little cheap little voice recorders, because there's no shielding in those things. They have very poor shielding. They're designed for you to dictate into. We use a little bit higher level recorder. I mean, I'm using Tascam DR07s, which are a pretty high quality digital recorder, and we don't have that issue. I have to use a dynamic microphone in order to capture EVPs with them, because the built-in condenser mics won't pick them up.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think we're just about covering the waterfront on this thing. So you got this book coming out right now. I'm gonna end up here, sum up here, and plug both of you here for our listeners, because this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion, and I am just really, I've learned a heck of a lot. I got to tell you, both of you, you've given me a lot of really, really exciting ideas, and so what I want to do here is sum up and summarize, and you guys can help me summarize this whole thing. Our topic this evening has been paranormal technology, and we've been emphasizing audio devices and EVP and electronic voice phenomenon and spirit radios. And we discussed some of the audiovisual aspects of it, and we've discussed most of the problems with it. We've also, and this has been really, really fascinating, because we've talked about how the subliminal aspect of it. What it generates in the mind, and David has provided us with a very good method of corroborating that information, which means that we can, as I said, put the channeling process involved in this on a bit more of a reliable basis, which is important. Mark has discussed the multiverse receiver, which we have in our Seventh Ray article. Now, David Rountree, who has been our guest and our very, very special guest, and he is, I think, one of the world's foremost authorities on this subject, ghost hunting and paranormal technology. And he is the author of the book Paranormal Technology, which covers information that we discussed tonight in more depth, and is really, really readable. Although, several times David jokes about how his head hurts when he gets into all the physics, but the physics, the parallel worlds theories and the wormhole theories and all this is fascinating, and this is the really, really exotic end of this, but it's real science. This is really, and David takes this all the way from the top all the way down to the nuts and bolts in paranormal technology, and that book is available. I got it from Amazon, and copyright 2010. By David M. Rountree, and so I strongly recommend that book. Mark Nelson, Dr. X, has our other expert, and Mark is a former NASA engineer and an electronic industry consultant, and Mark is the author of The Multiverse Receiver, which is a small book length, actually, in the Seventh Ray. It's a lengthy and very detailed article on the history of all these devices and our plans and ideas for the Multiverse Receiver, which we've been discussing tonight. And I want to thank both of you for being with us. The Seventh Ray, of course, is that Mark's article is in. Is the Seventh Ray, Book 3, The Green Ray, and that is available also on Amazon. In fact, I'm sending off a dozen of them tomorrow to Amazon, so it'll be there and in stock, and you can order it right now. And I want to thank both of you for being with us and for being wonderful guests. And next week, John Sheffield, one of our associate members, has asked a very, very good question, and John, if you're listening, we want you on as a call-in guest next week on this. And John said, let's have a show on building magical equipment. And because John's got a sigil of Emmeth and original wax and everything, and painted, and he's got his temple all painted dark blue, and he's really going at it. So next week We're going to talk about building magical equipment. And those of you who are interested in that, and even those of you who are not particularly going to build equipment, still you're going to learn something about how we build this equipment and how to use it, how all kinds of ins and outs about how to equip your magical temple. And so, until then, next week, with magical equipment, and we'll see you then. And meanwhile, good magic.